For antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, I'm Scott Horton, and this is Anti-War Radio. My guest is Daniel Ellsberg. He is a true, not the TV kind, the real kind of American hero. He is the man who ended the Vietnam War. In fact, if he hadn't done what he did, we'd probably still be fighting in Vietnam right now, for all I know. And what he did was he stole the Pentagon Papers, the secret history of the Vietnam War, and at the risk of a prison term of life, he could have spent the rest of his life in jail. He determined to get that secret history of the Vietnam War out to senators, who of course wouldn't publicize it, and finally to the New York Times and other papers, who finally published it and helped bring about the end of that war. Also, Richard Nixon's botched attempts to persecute this American hero, Daniel Ellsberg, led to his downfall. So we can be doubly thankful for Daniel Ellsberg, and I'm extra thankful to have you on the show today. Welcome, sir.
Well, thank you for that welcome. I do feel called on to cool down a little of that welcome. It would certainly be wrong to say that I ended the Vietnam War. I'd be very happy if that were the case. That's certainly, I would have loved to be able to do that, and I was trying to help do that. But the truth is, the reality is, that I first gave the Pentagon Papers to the Senate in 1969. Then, when they didn't do anything, I gave them to the press in 71. And the war went on until 1975. U.S. troops didn't leave until early 73, and our bombing continued until mid-73 when Congress ended it. And our support for the war in terms of paying the troops that we had been supporting all that time, providing with napalm and with planes, making them, I think, the third largest, in terms of numbers, air force in the world, amazing as that sounds, before they failed in 1975. So the war went on for a while after that, for years, 4 years after the Pentagon Papers came out. So it does happen, actually, that in an indirect way, but not just accidental way, the efforts of the Nixon administration to neutralize me, quote, in various criminal ways, very like, by the way, the efforts that are on trial right now to neutralize what Joe Wilson was saying about the Iraq War, that led them into possibly criminal behavior, were critical in bringing down, in Nixon's obstruction of justice, cover-up, for which he was eventually investigated for impeachment, and led to his resignation. And that, in turn, did make the war endable. So there was a connection there. And to that extent, all the people who inspired me as in the anti-war movement, of which I came to be part, all played their role. And none of us individually were enough to do the job. It was very hard to end that war. And a lot of people worked very, very hard at it, as hard as I did, for sure, and earlier than I did in many cases. And it finally succeeded, but the war could have gone on a lot longer.
Well, I didn't mean to deny others their credit, but I think if that whole era had happened and you had been, you know, a softball coach somewhere in Indiana or something, that it sure would have been a lot different history.
Well, to be very specific, if Nixon hadn't feared that I had copied papers beyond the Pentagon Papers, the Pentagon Papers ended in 1968 before he came into office, and Nixon feared, with reason, that I had documents on his own administration, just as saying now Bush feared what Joe Wilson knew about his own administration. If it weren't for that, he wouldn't have taken the criminal actions against me, even though I had put out the Pentagon Papers. He would have put me on trial, but he wouldn't have taken these criminal actions that actually brought him down. And I'm sorry to say the Pentagon Papers, as just history, would not have had much, and I really have to say any effect on the outcome of the war. As it was, the concern that I had documents on him, and I did have some and put them out, but not as much as he feared, that led him to actions that brought him down and did help end the war. And the relevance of that is that what I've been saying now for a couple of years, I've been urging people not to do what I did, not to wait till the war has started, where the bombs have fallen in Iran, let us say now, looking at the immediate future, and not to wait until documents in their position have become just history about previous administrations, but to take the risks, which are essentially the same risks as I took, but with, I think, much greater effect. Take the risks, they will have much greater effect if they take the same risks of prosecution and of going to prison that I took, but to do it in a much more timely way with documents looking toward the future and documents about current planning and current lies, current criminal actions that implicate the people in office that are still in office.
You wrote in Harper's...
If they have the willingness to do that, I think that there's a real chance of averting some catastrophes in the future.
You wrote in Harper's Magazine that a senator named Wayne Morse had asked you, why did you wait so long? You know, you could have stopped this whole thing.
Well, the way he put it was that if I had done what, unfortunately, no one had done, and in a way no one has done to this date, if I had put out current documents when I had them in 1964, 65, before the war, then that could have stopped the war. And I think he's true. That's true. Now, he didn't lay it on me, you know, you should have done this, you should have stopped the war. He just said, you could have done this. And that was true, and it's what I'm saying to people now. The reason I think that he didn't make it too personal about how bad I'd been, and I must say I regret not having done that, was it isn't done. No one has done it. What I'm asking for right now has essentially not been done by anybody, and I'm aware of that. There's one exception to that. Catherine Gunn in England was a young interpreter, translator, at the British equivalent of the National Security Agency, the Communications Intelligence Agency, GCHQ, in England. And when she saw a very highly classified document come over her computer that showed that our NSA was calling on the British to engage in illegal activities to pursue an illegal war, specifically to tap the home and office phones of every member of the UN Security Council, in violation of treaties, by the way, as well as domestic law, in order to coerce them or and manipulate them into supporting what was clearly an unprovoked aggressive war, she acted right away. She didn't wait till the war had started, and she didn't think it over for months, or she didn't wait to write her memoirs, as I noticed George Tenet is in the process of doing right now. She put that out before the war, and I think she, it's too long to go into now, but I think she played an important role in keeping the UN, the other members of the UN Security Council, from endorsing that war and obscuring the fact that it was a clear-cut aggressive war. She had a chance of keeping her own country from going into that war, the British, on the grounds that without UN Security Council authorization, it was clearly aggressive, as is the case. And she didn't succeed in that. Blair went ahead anyway. But she had a good chance, and she risked jail. She was put on trial for that. And her trial actually was called off when the British government realized that they were going to have witnesses come forth and assert that the war was illegal. They didn't want that discussion at that time, so they dropped the trial.
Yeah, even their attorney general said so, right?
Their attorney general had said so, and that was kept secret for much longer. Eventually, that leaked out. And that was good. Whoever leaked it out, and I have some ideas, did a good thing.
If I can clarify one thing.
That their attorney general, Peter Goldsmith, had ruled that without UN authorization, the war was, he made several rulings, but they led up to very questionably legal or illegal. Those could have come out a lot earlier. The Downing Street memos could have come out when they were first written back in 2002, and that could have averted the whole war.
Mm-hmm. Now, if the United Nations Security Council had voted for it, it still would have been an aggressive war, as you say. That would have only obscured the fact by giving it the pretense of some sort of legality.
Right.
But it was still an unprovoked war against a helpless nation.
Well, the Richard Falk, a very good international lawyer, has argued that even an authorization by the UN Security Council could be held to violate the letter and spirit of the UN Charter, as you've just indicated. However, that would be an argument. Who would address that? It's a hard question. And certainly they would argue the UN Charter can also be read to say, well, if the UN Security Council authorizes it, that makes it not illegal. It makes it because it's a doctrine. But you'd have the same issue that you have now with the question of whether it's constitutional. Yes, the Congress did delegate its authority to start a war first in Afghanistan and then in Iraq to the president. It can very well be argued, I think soundly, that the Congress has no right to delegate that the Congress Constitution doesn't allow for that. And aside from that, even if they directly declared war, you'd have a very strong case that they had been misled. They'd been consciously, deliberately misled and deceived and manipulated so that the Constitution had been subverted. I don't have any question in my mind that the people who participated in that deception, who were officials like myself who'd taken the same oath I did, or that Lieutenant Ouattara did, who was just on trial, which is an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution, were violating that oath. I violated that oath when I kept my mouth shut in 64, 65 without realizing it, without thinking about it. And I'm sure these people haven't thought about it either. But that's the issue that Lieutenant Ouattara raises, that to take part in the direct manipulation of Congress is, in fact, a violation of their constitutional responsibility.
Well, I just interviewed Representative Walter Jones yesterday, who told me that absolutely he felt like he was deceived, that he had no idea that Douglas Feith and his buddies at the Pentagon had been doing an end run around the CIA and their intelligence gathering.
Yeah.
He thought that all those allegations had come straight from the best analysts at the CIA, and why question it?
Well, really, of course, he had somewhat better access than I in Congress, although I might say worse, is a little more subject to direct manipulation. But I would say that you may have understood better at that time. A lot of people did. I myself, with all the skepticism that I've acquired in the last 35 years, I still felt that they wouldn't be making such flat statements about there is no doubt, we know where they are, we have this and that. I really didn't think that those people like Powell and others would be sticking their necks out quite that clearly if they didn't have something.
No, I was the same way. I thought, well, they must have at least one warehouse with some old mustard gas cans in it or something.
Yeah.
Something.
It was plausible enough. I mean, there's, after all, no more reason to believe Saddam Hussein than George Bush. He's a government official. So the mere fact that he said that he had destroyed all his stuff is certainly not the last word. So I, on the whole, believe there probably were WMDs. What was obvious was that if they did, they did not constitute a threat to the United States or to world order that in any way justified an attack or an invasion or an occupation. And now we get back to Iran. Even if Iran is doing all the things they're accused of at this point, which is very much in question, though not at all surprising if they're doing some of them, if you step back a moment from that and say, does that create a situation which either justifies legally or makes it prudent and appropriate to launch a war against them? That's very easy to answer. That's not that one is not hard to answer. They're not doing anything remotely. They're not even being accused of doing anything that would justify a war against them. And if we move to the question, can this be stopped? Here we have a situation where months ago, Time magazine had a cover story in Iran that sort of went by the boards. It was before the election, and it didn't arouse any lasting debate. It didn't enter into the election particularly well, but that added up to the high likelihood that the U.S. was going to attack Iran, was preparing for it. For one thing, I think it was the first one of the carrier groups was on its way over at that time. We have a second one joining it now, and there's all indications that there's going to be a third carrier task force in that area very shortly. and by the spring. So they looked at that and they said, well, clearly there's planning going on here for possible war with Iran. Then they quoted a lot of experts implying this would be disastrous, be a catastrophe. The effects on the war in Iraq, the effects on the Persian Gulf, the effects on oil worldwide, and on the definitive conclusion that the U.S. was at war with Islam, something that would have worldwide repercussions. All of that made it madness. And then the question arose, there was a heading, subheading, I remember in the Time magazine, can it be stopped? Now there's something a little, you know, worthy of note on that one. Here we have an insane policy, you know, with no justification, virtually no benefit that one could find for it. Can it be stopped in this, what we still think of as a democracy? Well, that remains still very much in question. And I would say, as of this moment, that first, the odds really are in favor of, in terms of prediction, that this attack will happen within the next 18 months while Bush is in office, and that those odds are very high unless many people in our society act very differently from anything we've seen so far, unless Democrats change their performance very much, unless Republicans do, unless courts, that's at least to rely on at this moment, the media, various parts of our society, any associations, unions, citizens at large, churches, I would say all of these institutions have failed us on Iraq to prevent a disastrous, aggressive war and war crimes in Iraq. They failed. Our checks and balances failed, just as we were failed by those same constitutional provisions. Our system failed to keep us out of Vietnam. But in the case of Vietnam, a number of those institutions really, one by one or together, did take hold. The courts played a role, the media played a role, and Congress cut off the funding, ultimately. For that, there was an impeachment process, and all of those things finally did redeem themselves to some extent, very belatedly, after 10 years. In this case, the failure is clear, if anything, sooner than it was in Vietnam, in the case of Iraq. And what I'm now focusing on, we're now facing a whole new one. Just years, a few years after we were failed by our Congress, by our intelligence institutions, by our executive branch, in Iraq, the same process, the same degree of failure is confronting us in a whole new escalation of the war, basically a new war. And the test of us is twofold. Can we prevent an out-of-control, deeply foolish president? I'm using to some degree euphemistic words there, but I think they're justified at least. And you could use stronger words, but a dangerous administration and a dangerously undemocratic administration, can we use our constitutional system and our consciences and our political activity to prevent them from killing countless more people in a new country and engaging us in endangering our own security, in shaming us and dishonoring us newly, in addition to everything that's happened so far in the last 6 years? Can we do this? And I can see ways that Richard can be done. There are specific things that can be done, but they call for a kind of moral courage that we have not seen much of in the last 6 years.
Well, I wonder at this point whether there's really much to blow the whistle on. As you say, we all know that they want to have a war, and we all know it's obviously a matter of public record to anybody with a simple search engine to find out that all the accusations are false.
I disagree with you on the case of Iran. If we're talking about the whistleblowing is only one of the things I'm talking about here.
Well, sure, you're right.
But, because when I talk about Congress, they have an important role as the investigators and the recipients of leaks and of testimony. But the courage that we need there is people to hold hearings, people to take responsibility for putting restraint on the president, both in Iraq, but now we're talking mainly about Iran at this moment. And things like Walter Jones, HJR 14, which forbids the president to attack Iran without congressional authorization. And I hope, I'm not sure that that has a funding aspect to it, does it or not, that they say no funds shall be available, no funds shall be expended for combat operations against Iran without congressional authorization and so forth.
Honestly, I don't have it in front of me, but I don't believe that it is specific about money. It is talking about the authority to do it.
And his effort is very good, but it could be in the form of a non-binding kind of thing, as the kind of things are doing now, which is only a good first step, but it's not the major thing. The major thing would be to say no funds shall be available for this, as I just put it. And if the president ignores that, which he might well do, then a couple of people, I think Larry Diamond and some others, have pointed out that Congress should then immediately bring a lawsuit. I'm not sure about the legal aspects of that. I'm quoting him. And begin impeachment proceedings for violating that law. And that would be, obviously, there are people who correctly say that there are already more than grounds for impeachment, but they're a minority. And the threat would be there that that minority will suddenly swell very abruptly if he should ignore a law like that. So to bring to bear the power of the purse before the war. And that can certainly be done.
And again, that's House Joint Resolution 14 is the one that's out there so far. And I urge everybody to contact their congressman in support of that. But you're right. It could be a way to set it up so that there's no question that if he does attack Iran, that he is violating the law in the sense that is impeachable under the strictest interpretation of the impeachment clauses of the Constitution.
That's right. They can make a law, and they can use their power of the purse in a way that even this administration admits in principle they have that power. In fact, they're challenging them to do it. And that's not an entirely unfair challenge. Of course, they're doing it disingenuously. These are people who want to continue the war to the disastrous effect for the U.S. They want to attack Iran. So their motives for the following proposal are not admirable. But the proposal is, if you guys really feel what you say, put up or shut up. Show some courage here. They use the word courage. Cut off the funds. They could just as well say impeach, knowing that, strictly speaking, it would be a lot easier. It would be easier to get the money for, to get the votes for cutting off the funds, probably, than for impeachment. But in either case, knowing that they don't want to do that. And the reason they don't want to do that, let me infer, is that neither the Democrats nor the Republicans in Congress want to take responsibility for the aftermath of not going to war. If things go badly in Iraq, if you get out, if you cut off the funds for Iraq, things may indeed get much worse. They're going to get much worse if we stay. In fact, they're going to get much worse in the next 2 months, I would predict. With the 20,000 surge, it's going to make things worse. That's my expectation. But and a year from now, they'll be still worse. If you get out, will everything be solved? We really don't know. There's great uncertainty there. But they may get worse. The Democrats and Republicans alike in Congress, and this has been true for 50 years, are quite happy to lay back, despite the responsibility the Constitution has put on them, and ignore the fact that the Constitution gives them a role in this and gives them responsibility, and let the president get the credit or the blame. And in this case, there ain't going to be a lot of credit. Everybody can see that. So let the president take the blame. We'll run against his record 2 years from now, say the Democrats. We'll inherit the White House. We'll get a larger majority in Congress. And meanwhile, the war will be much greater. There will be war against Iran as well, and there may have been use of nuclear weapons. I'm saying that's an absolutely normal political stance for for them to take, for either party.
Right.
And it has, it unfortunately, it's despicable because it involves very consciously failing to do what they could do to avert this situation getting very much worse in the short run. Failing to avert the possible use of nuclear weapons against Iran is extremely irresponsible and extremely predictable by these people, unless we demand unusual behavior from them. Even Jones' bill, and this is not a criticism, but his bill should have added to it that whereas you don't attack Iran without congressional authorization, without debate, without et cetera, it should say, in my opinion, and you don't use nuclear weapons against Iran under any circumstances whatever.
Absolutely.
That should be added. And that isn't to authorize, of course, non-nuclear weapons. It's just to say, we want to absolutely be clear, no nuclear weapons. And the notion that nuclear weapons should be on the table directly endangers not just America, but by legitimizing the notion that any one country has the right to initiate nuclear war, starting with us or anybody else, and if us, anybody else has that right, that endangers the human of our, the future of our species. That's as dangerous a position as could be taken by any country in the world.
Yep.
And that's what we're doing right now.
Well, there's a little bit of good news, which is Hillary Mann, who co-wrote the thing for the New York Times a month or so ago with Flint Leverett about how Iran had tried to make peace with the United States and their efforts had been thwarted.
No.
She has now come out to Newsweek magazine in yesterday's issue of Newsweek.
Funny. My wife just brought that in and put it down in front of me as we talk. I see the cover here. I haven't read it though.
Oh, well, in there is the quote of Hillary Mann, and in fact, I just saw someone had emailed me a clip of her on the internet from CNN, where she has come right out and said she believes that the policy is to deliberately provoke Iran into attacking us first, which means to me that if America is successful in provoking Iran to attacking us first somehow, we'll at least have it on the record that this was predicted by a woman who was, in charge of the Iraq desk on the National Security Council for George Bush. So this is what you're talking about, people coming out and blowing the whistle before the war starts rather than after it's too late.
Well, that is good, and I would add just one thing to that. By the way, if you have it in front of you, what page is that?
I don't have it in front of me.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I only read it online.
I'll get it. But I presume she is not quoting official sources by name nor presenting documents.
No, that's
okay.
Correct.
She's doing, in other words, what the journalistic task that Cy Hirsch has performed very admirably for the last couple of years on Iran. She's presenting people that she vouches for as their authority, their source, but she's protecting the source on their behalf, on their request, presumably. Unfortunately, Cy Hirsch has done this so much that if that were enough, we wouldn't be in the situation we are now. The word would have gotten out. It's not enough. It clearly is not enough. We need the documents. We need the names. And the reason for the names is so that people can be called before Congress, asked to testify under oath in closed session if necessary, and they can be interrogated as to how they know, what they know, so that it carries real compelling weight. Without the documents, as I've learned from my own experience, I know I've put out word that I knew was correct. I'd read the documents, but I didn't have them to put out. And I have a pretty good track record, but I've had a lot of experience that people find it very easy to dismiss what I've said without those documents. And I've wished very much that I had the documents put out, in which case I would have done it. And what I'm asking these people is to recognize that, yes, for them to identify themselves and to put out documents does greatly increase the risk to their careers and to their parents, to their families, to their children's education, to a lot of things that are very important to them, and I'm not at all sneering at that, but I am saying that where war and peace is at stake, and innumerable lives are at stake, they should consider personal risk. Of the same sort, a different kind, but comparable to the risks that we're asking young men and women to take every hour of the day in Iraq. And we'll be asking in Iran. In Iran, it'll be mostly air attack and cruise missiles, and various things that the U.S. casualties immediately will probably be very small, although the casualties from Iranian retaliation may not be small at all, and a lot of them may be at home. But in Iraq, as a former platoon leader and company commander, and somebody then who is a civilian, saw pacification from very close up in Vietnam, I actually shudder at the thought of what lieutenants are having to ask their men to do, and women now, to do in Iraq when they just step out, foot outside the base. There's no place to hide. Constant stress and tension. The fact that the ambushes are in the cities makes it in many ways much more grisly. It confronts them with split-second choices of whether a taxi coming at them is a suicide bomber or not, which inevitably involves them in what they quickly come to realize are killing civilians, children, babies, old women, old men, not all of which is, they're put in situations where they can hardly avoid doing that, and they'll feel the effects of that the rest of their lives. If we ask people to do that by the hundreds of thousands of Americans, 140,000 at a time, but overall a lot more than that. I don't see why we don't encourage and demand and expect of some of our civilians, both in Congress and in the officials, to risk their careers. If we're asking so many people to risk their bodies, their legs, their genitals, their lives, why can't we expect an official, some of these same people, their superiors, to risk their careers? And the answer is that simply to expect that on the basis of past experience is very naive, because that's not the way humans behave.
Well, in your book, you talk about the power of being brought in on secrets. You even say that you yourself were drunk on secrets, and the idea that you knew all these things that everybody else out there didn't know, and how that helped you to keep your mouth shut, because the idea, I guess, is that if you can just go along to get along a little bit longer, then you can get a little bit higher position and be able to use your influence a little bit better, and so people in government service will keep their mouths shut about things that are absolutely horrible for years and years, in the hopes that one day they'll be close enough to the real boss to be able to say something about it.
Well, that's right. They're for their lifetime, actually. I wish that we got a lot more deathbed confessions than we do, but we don't, as a matter of fact. People take their secrets to the grave as if they expect to be channeled from the other side as consultants, having preserved their reputation as reliable, discreet, trustworthy people who never talk. I noticed, for instance, there's a new book coming out, I just saw this on the web, by Tyler Drumheller, a CIA guy. I guess his book came out a year ago, but he was just interviewed. He was head of European intelligence for operations, I think, actually, for CIA. And so they asked him. This was a real interview just this week. And he's very critical of the war and very critical of Bush, really, I think, in various ways. But they keep asking him questions like, and you were involved in the rendition problem, right? The kidnapping to foreign countries. He says, well, yes. He actually went so far as to say, I would be lying if I said no. Well, actually, people in his position feel it's their duty to say no, even though it is a lie, if to keep the secret. But so in this case, he's going beyond the bounds. And then they say, well, tell us more about this, and that. Oh, I've agreed not to tell any of that. This is a man now who's criticizing the war, who's to some extent a whistleblower, though not at the time, but in his memoir. Now, what exactly is the risk he's taking if he does answer some of those questions? The risk, in legal terms, is that he would be deprived of the royalties on his book. No one has ever gone to jail for telling secrets of the CIA. afterwards. But people like Frank Smith and John Stockwell, I believe, and various others have been deprived of their royalties. And that is what keeps his mouth shut still, even as he sees us going into a new war based on the same lies as before. Now, that's not unusually despicable, cowardly behavior. It's usually despicable. It's normal. That's what's done. What I'm saying is that we need, in the next 18 months, to somehow evoke some abnormal behavior. And the people we can... I'm appealing to people who were sitting in the kinds of jobs I had at the time, but all of us are in a position to tell Republicans and Democrats that they will face primary competition in otherwise safe seats if they don't tell the truth and if they don't demand truth from the administration in investigations right now, if they don't vote to avert a war in Iran and to end a war in Iraq, they will face... we can also, of course, make a moral appeal to them. They, too, have maybe an oath to the Constitution, not to the President,
well,
to
and,
the Constitution.
And the Constitution, speaking of it, it is really, at the end of the day, it gives all the power to the people and to the House of Representatives. They're up for re-election or unelection every 2 years. And if we really feel like holding them accountable, we can. And I would not bother appealing to the morality of a congressman in most cases. But
I'd like to raise the standards here and make them aware, because one of the things that confirms them, a lot of them, and especially in the executive branch, but also in Congress, in their craven careerist behavior, is that it is, after all, required of them. They actually have an image in their mind that, especially if they're in the executive branch, that they have actually taken an oath to obey orders of superiors, like orders to keep secrecy. Actually, they haven't. They made an agreement, an employment agreement, a secrecy agreement of that sort. Their oath was to the Constitution. It wasn't to the President. To be very specific here, enlisted men do take an oath when they come in to obey superior orders and to obey the President. And why there's that striking difference in the oaths, I'm not sure historically. But the fact is that the oath that officers and officials take is to obey the Constitution. It is not to a Führer. It is not to a Commander-in-Chief. They don't have a Commander-in-Chief if they're civilians.
Right.
Nor do we. And it is not to superior officers or to their agency. They honestly, I know this is sincere, they've never been led to believe, to imagine, that there could be a conflict between what their officials want, or what, above all, what the President wants, and what the Constitution demands. But, you know, it's been 30 years since Vietnam and Watergate, and it's been 3 years since we were lied into Iraq. And it should begin to penetrate at this point that what the President's judgment and the President's orders are not necessarily synonymous with the demands of the Constitution.
Right. Well, now in the military, you brought up that their oath does include obeying orders, and that, of course, is to ensure civilian control over the military. However, they're only supposed to obey lawful orders. And those, that is lawful as in referring to the Congress and the Constitution.
Yeah.
They're not just supposed to do whatever they're told.
Well, and that's what Todd's point, that this is, we were lied into this war, it was an unconstitutional war, it's a war involving war crimes, and Lieutenant Aaron Watata took the position that he could not deploy, would not deploy, it was his duty not to deploy to Iraq, because that would involve obeying illegal orders. And his trial was just stopped on virtually a technicality here. He may well not be tried again. But he was certainly expecting and ready to go to prison for that. I would say that Watata is the single officer of the United States Armed Services. I wish I... this may sound funny, but I would laugh at him if he was a Marine, which I was. But he happens to be in the Army. He's the single officer in all of the armed services, the single official in the U.S. government who is taking seriously his oath to uphold the Constitution. Now, that isn't to say that all of the others or all the others are consciously violating that. I think quite the contrary. They've never faced the question. That's what I mean by saying they're not taking it seriously. When they take that oath, they're beginners. When they take it again and again, one way or another, for new clearances or whatever, they've never gotten around, I would say for most of them, to looking at their own experience and what they've had occasion to learn and saying, could that involve me in perhaps a conflict with what a rogue president, such as we have now, is a man who is trying consciously to overturn our constitutional form of government and to involve us in illegal wars. Could that involve a conflict with my oath paying him? Well, Todd is the one who's taken that seriously as a question. He's faced it. And there's really only one answer you can come if you inform yourself, as they all could do. And he's acted on that, and he risked prison. I'm saying he was absolutely right to do that. I admire him unreservedly. And I know that he would feel he was right to do that, even if he had to go to prison, or if he does. I don't know of a single draft resister, and I know quite a few of them, who went to prison in order to oppose a wrongful war in Vietnam, who regretted the decision they'd made. As one said to me just the other day, Randy Keeler, not for a second did I ever regret the, I think, 22 months or so that he spent in prison. As a result of that, he knew that he'd done the right thing. And I'm saying, unless we have Congress, men and women, who are ready, I'll change the focus here, who are ready to risk losing election, how would they do that? By being called traitors, weaklings, not supporting the troops, being called names without any validity, and having a foreign, out of state, out of district money come into their district to oppose them in primaries on this, as Cynthia McKinney had and others. If they should be willing to risk that, as Barbara Lee in Oakland was, in being the single person in all of Congress to oppose an undebated delegation of authority to go to war against Afghanistan in 2001. She said that she wasn't necessarily against that war, but she was against doing it without any debate, without any hearings, without any real evidence. And having been told by many members, including many other members of the Black Caucus, that they would vote against that, she realized during the voting she would be the only one. And she had a sinking feeling. And it wasn't her desire to be the single spokesperson for that constitutional point of view. And she didn't budge. She went ahead and voted against it, and she did not change her vote when urged to do so in the cloakroom afterwards, before she still had time to do it. That's the kind of behavior we need to applaud and support and get other people to emulate. That gives us a chance to avert this war in Iran. I would say that if we still had the president's party in control of both houses of Congress, which was very possible, and very, on the edge, just as easy as the other, as what happened. If that had been the outcome of the election, I personally wouldn't see any hope of avoiding this war, and certainly not of ending Iraq. As it is, we have a chance if we push it. If we can, with the kind of pressure I've been talking about putting on Congress, there's an old expression on the Hill, they may not see the light, but they'll feel the heat. And we can provide that heat, but it's up to us to do it, and we have to give it quite high priority. It means changing our own way of life in the next 18 months and spending time and effort telling our congressional representatives and the people in Congress, and I would include the Republicans in this, that they have to do better than they've done before, than virtually almost any of them. There are a few who really done what they could, I would say. Barbara Lee would be one. Lynn Woolsey here is very good. Dennis Kucinich. Feingold in the Senate has behaved very well and just had good hearings on the issue.
Ron Paul in the House.
Ron Paul, very good. And of course, Walter Jones, who reversed his position earlier and has definitely taken the lead. Being a libertarian, like Paul, of course, is very helpful to seeing the light.
All right, well, since you're Daniel Ellsberg, I'd like to go ahead and finish with the question of whether you think, and this is, I guess, Iran to the side, whether you think that the American people are ready to become ill again with that Vietnam syndrome.
Well, of course, yeah, I don't want to endorse your use of the metaphor there, because the notion that it was an illness or a pathology is, of course, as you know, the Bush-Reagan attitude. That's like saying, do we want to catch the contagion, I wish it were more of a contagion, of democracy and of being a republic, being a heretic in an otherwise monarchical or dictatorial world. I don't want to call that pathology at all. I'm going to say that the health of our republic depends on the preserving and building on the awareness that we achieved painfully and costly, and above all in terms of cost borne by other people, by Vietnamese, in the Vietnam era, which is that untrammeled executive power is not healthy for either this republic, for any republic, or for the world. In a country of such power as this, and that checks and balances were among the very good ideas in the Constitution. There were things in the Constitution that were not exemplary and admirable, like support for slavery and the subordination of women and various other things. Our treatment, of course, of the Native American, and so on, which was not
the power to tax.
Well, okay. Now you're jumping beyond
the power to raise an army.
Yeah,
okay, I'm sorry.
Context. But I'm not. In other words, to say it was not a perfect document, but interestingly allowed for amendment. And in the case of women and slavery, of course, you did get amendments. The first 10 amendments are worth memorizing, I think, and preserving in our memory, because lest they become nothing but a memory. So in other words, the separation of powers, the giving the power of war and peace solely to Congress was a terrific idea and invention, which of course has greatly eroded in the last 60 years, starting, as we said before the program, I'm sorry to say, with a Democrat, Harry Truman. And in Korea, but all our presidents since then have contributed to that, and of course Congress has gone along with it. My point is that document, as amended, does have principles in it that are worth dying for. They were worth fighting for, worth dying for. I'll add one thing to that, for instance, that wasn't envisioned in the Constitution. I think it's worth struggling and dying to avert the next use of nuclear weapons. I would do that in a minute. And I would do that as I would have all my life, to avert the transformation of this country into what amounts to an authoritarian elected monarchy, or almost elected monarchy, of the kind that this administration has in mind. And I think that sacrifice and risk are well worthwhile to avert these looming catastrophes, and they are necessary. And it'll come about only if we provide examples ourselves, and if we demand them and expect them and urge them on people who are in a position to act more courageously than they have done. I think that the potential is there as humans, and the potential is also there for denying the need for these things and for turning our thoughts away and for being distracted by other problems. But we're in a crisis right now where I think, thanks to the fact that an opposition party has taken office in the House and Senate, we have the capability for hearings, if they're willing to hold them, probing hearings where questions are demanded and not allowed to be denied, where subpoenas are issued, and where whistleblowers have a chance to go and be heard. And under those circumstances, I think we have a chance that we would not have otherwise, and that puts responsibility on us.
Ladies and gentlemen, Daniel Ellsberg, American hero, the man who stole the Pentagon Papers. His book is Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers. His websites are ellsberg.net and truthtellingproject.org. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for the opportunity.